This is May 7th, 2013. This is Nancy Wiegand. This is the start of a session called Semantics in Geospatial and Other Architectures, Design and Implementation. Slide 2, please. So the motivation for this workshop is that there's an increasing interest in semantic technology. Some people have built systems already and have used certain methods, and other people are interested in building and using semantics. So this workshop is to see what has been done and to discuss future needs and opportunities. And there's I'm considering having a possible follow-up workshop that would be an in-person workshop in the fall, say October, maybe here in Madison, Wisconsin. And people can send email or discuss later whether they would be interested in that. The speakers today are listed here. This is the short introduction. People have 20-minute time slots. If there's time to ask questions in that time slot, then we'll do that. Otherwise, the questions can be at the end. There's also a chat room where people can pose and get questions answered. For the speakers, please remember to say the slide number. I think I just forgot to do that. This is slide 3 now. Say the slide number when you advance. And if you have your own phone muted, make sure to unmute that and press star 7 to get unmuted in general. Slide 4. The acknowledgments are that this is work being done through an NSF Interop grant. And I want to also thank Gary Bird-Cross and Peter Yim, who are on the grant, for helping and hosting this workshop. And this proposal, the Interop proposal, was submitted by SOCOP, and just so people know what that is, it's a spatial ontology community of practice. It's a group of people interested in semantic technologies, but specifically interested in the spatial and geospatial area, and the group started in about 2006. And I just put the session page on there for reference later. So at this point, then, the first speaker is Douglas Sills from the Consortium for Ocean Leadership. So, Doug, are you online?
Yeah, I am online. Can you hear me?
Yes, that's fine.
Okay. Pardon me. First off, thank you also to Nancy, Gary, and Peter for hosting this and for inviting me to give a little presentation about some of the things that we've been doing within IODP. First, let me describe a little bit about what IODP is. It's the Integrated Ocean Drilling Program, and we run the Geoides Resolution, which is a deep sea drilling vessel. And so we retrieve subsea flow cores for science use. It's a National Science Foundation program. And program has implementing organizations at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, Texas A&M, and at Ocean Leadership. And so what we were going to talk about today, if we could advance the slide two, what we were going to talk about today is an effort that's taking place at dataoceandrilling.org. And I should note that this is not a production site. This is actually a test site that was set up by the data managers within IODP. The data managers realized that there were some issues with the sharing and distribution of our data that is collected by the JR. We collect a very heterogeneous set of data, from core images to log files that are themselves described by metadata, to actually physical property point samples, and also samples along the core and elements like this, pictures of bugs, everything. And so we had this very heterogeneous type environment, and we wanted to explore some new ways in which we could distribute this information and link these various bits of information together through things like EarthCube. And other workshops and efforts, we've become aware of some other people that have been working on some of these things as well. Both Bob Arco, Chris Jenkins, Cindy Chandler, and some others at Woods Hole Stace, Andy Carla at NGDC. These are a group of people that have been experimenting with RDF, linked open data, and other elements. And so, you know, I want to give a good shout out to them and some of the efforts that they've been doing, and I'll describe some of those as we go through some of these other slides. Let's go ahead and advance to slide 3 if we could. One of the reasons that this was important to us is that our community has to search multiple locations, potentially, multiple data sets. Those might be at NGDC, they might be hosted by IOTP, they might be third parties that are associated with our drilling data. And the manner in which they had to search might be different, and just finding the actual locations of this. So this was a situation that really cried out for trying to find a way to relate this data, to link this data, and to try and assist our domain scientists in getting access to it. The other problem that we had, too, was that from the data manager and developer standpoint, because I also do software development work for the distribution of this data, we were having a situation where data and logic and connections between those logic, between those data was finding itself embedded in our code base when it should have been in our data model. This made things difficult to maintain, difficult to upgrade. We had things of importance spread throughout the entire stack, from data to model, view, and controller, if you want to use that model. And we wanted to try and address this situation. We had a case where scientists were very good at finding things because they knew what they were looking for. But scientists who didn't know what they were looking for, scientists who were from outside of the drilling community, had a much harder time getting access to that. And part of that was an explosion in parameter space, different types of terms being used for similar types of observations and measurements. And so we really wanted to try and address this. You know, we have the anecdote that the NSF, I think, sometimes puts around that, you know, people spend 80% of their time trying to find their data and 20% of the time actually trying to work with it. So let's go ahead and advance to slide 4, if you could. And I'll talk just briefly about how we kind of approach this. This slide doesn't represent some of the historical background. We looked as the data management team at different types of solutions of expanding our relational model, of incorporating NoSQL or other graphs like Neo4j and things like this into the environment. But what we finally settled on was utilizing RDF and also looking at some of the things that we could do with linked open data, trying to follow some of the 5-star practices in terms of marking up and making our data open and connected to one another. And this resonated very well with us. And so we started that experiment. We set up a triple store. We're using Virtuoso, and we began to load data into that system. We mostly did ETLing of that data, so we wrote code that would actually extract the data from our existing relational models and convert it into triples and load it into that system. We did do some experimenting and are doing some experimenting with things like D2RQ. And we also have been using things like Google Refine, now Open Refine, and others to generate the data and load it into our triple stores. We also wanted to really advocate discovery because we differentiated that from search from the standpoint of we wanted people to have the ability to serendipitously discover related data as they were moving through all the types of records that we contained. And so that was also important to us, and we'll talk a little bit about how we address that. So let's go ahead and move to slide 5. And this is the first time I'm kind of showing some of the things that we set up at dataoceandrilling.org. And what we did here was we really wanted, sort of these are the web representations, the linked open data layer that's sitting on top of our triple store. And in this diagram, really what we're looking at is in the upper left corner, looking at the concept of a cruise or an expedition. So that might be someone coming in and saying, I'm particularly interested in you know, Expedition 301 or something along those lines. And from that, then we can begin to present to them information like lithology or publications or other things that might be associated with that. From a lithology, since everything is depth calibrated and we can make the relationships across the graphs, we can actually show people the core imagery that we have, the higher resolution core imagery. And then from there, we've been working with tool developers like CoreRef and CoreWall, and how they can actually talk to our data model then using things like Sparkle and others to make these queries and extract the high resolution images and then place them into visual type environments. And as you see in the lower right corner there with CoreRef, then we're actually retrieving and plotting physical properties data with that. So we're actually going in and trying to extract the data directly from the triple store. And that's a point that I want to make here, is that we're dealing with not only data sets, files, that we have metadata for, and that metadata is actually in the triple store. But we've actually got the real physical property samples, the measurement at a depth, at a point, on a core, recorded the value for things like P-wave velocity or magnetic susceptibility, and all those thousands and millions of records loaded in there. So we can actually begin to do things like looking for depth on a core and extracting physical property values from that, plotting that then against things like core imagery and things like this. And again, it speaks, I think, a little bit to the heterogeneous nature of our data, from imagery to plots to reports and things like that. Let's go ahead and advance to slide 6, if we could. At slide 6, as our previous page, I really want to kind of highlight that we had multiple viewing options available to us with this. One of the things as data managers that we liked about RTF was the flexibility that it gave us and some of the tools that were able to speak directly to that with very, very little effort on our part from a developer standpoint. Things like the MIT Simile timeline that we see here, things like HTML5 pivot viewer, and these other types of things that we could incorporate into this model. It gave us a flexibility to, support more types of interfaces than we would be able to do if we were trying to do this ourselves, right? So leveraging that tool base was very important to us. Let's go ahead and move to slide 7. And in fact, this is probably the first time that I can talk a little bit about federation and really kind of address it and some of the things that we did. As I mentioned at the beginning, there are some other groups like the Inter-Ridge Vents group at Woodsville Oceanographic and Carla Moore at NGDC, who are exposing data utilizing Sparkle and RDF. And so in this example, in the left side there, this application, which is totally client-side, which is another nice thing, so we're totally decoupled, we're totally client-side, and so via calls out to these Sparkle endpoints, we can collect up a collection of deep-sea ridge vents and use those. So when we retrieve those, we get their names, we get their geospatial location, and then we can use those based on the slider that you might be able to see there in the imagery to give a range. And based on that range, then present a set of drilling sites that IODP, ODP, or DSDP, the three programs over the past 40 years have done. Based on that information, then we can actually query out things like the NGDC Sparkle site and find things like samples that have been taken on these particular locations. And so people can go from using this event information all the way to getting information at NGDC and almost use IODP as a pass-through in that regard. And one of the nice things about this was, as we were discussing this within our group, was that it showed that we could actually utilize in an environment like this third-party data, not as something that we want to deliver, but as a means for discovery of our own data, right? So in this case, the ridge vents were used as a mechanism to discover associated drill sites. And of course, because of the two-way nature of this, the Ridge Vent group is interested in actually presenting to their users drill sites that might be near there, being able to drill down into physical properties or load up core imagery or things like that. So this was a nice example of really trying to exploit the federated capability that's presented to us as data managers from the STEPM environment. Let's go ahead and advance to slide 8 if we could. One of the other experiments that we did is that we had a very large collection of publication data. And so we could actually provide that information to people and have provided that information to people through simple things like solar type indexes. But one of the things that we knew was that we knew what those publications were associated with. And so we did an experiment by which we created graphs that associated the publication URLs with URIs associated with the expedition that they're about. And what that allowed then was for people to come in with free text type searching, free text terms, and go through the corpus of these publications and scientific reports and daily reports that come off the ship and provide a connection between that unstructured type environment and the structured data, so that if someone did a search on a particular term and got results back, we could actually look at the results from that, find the top kind of unique set of expeditions that would be associated with that, and then present to him or her the option to look at associated sample data, associated physical properties data, other things from our structured data side of things. And in fact, we see this as a means or as something that we can continue to exploit as we work with our publications group to embed schema.org and RDFA data into those web pages so that we can get better and better at associating discoveries based on free text searching with structured data results that are coming from this. So let's go ahead and advance on to slide 9, if we could. And so I just want to talk a little bit about how we kind of approach this. Again, we really wanted lots of entry points into this environment. We also wanted to be able to deal with bulk data extraction from this. And so one of the things that we did actually was leverage the RDF data cube proposal that exists now and put some of our data into some of our RDF data into that structure, which allowed us then to put slices, of course, do that. So we could slice on expedition, on site, but also could slice on things like the observation. And as we continue to experiment with this, doing things like converting depth to age using age depth models so that we can slice on a time period as well. And so people could come in then, this is the vision that we have for this, and be able to say, I want to facet in on a particular time, a particular set of pathologies, and I want then to extract all the data that matches that. And of course, one of the nice things too about using this type of environment is that things like R or IPython or other tools have Sparkle libraries that we can use, and we can actually build up automatically then the scripts that people could download and begin to utilize this. So we're really trying to have multiple ways in which people can get to the data and how they can interact with that data, everywhere from a web type environment all the way up to things like R and IPython or other specific domain type tools like CoreWall, Google GeoMap app, or things like that. As much as we wanted to link our data together, we really wanted to make sure that we decoupled as much as we could with the web architecture. So behind the scenes, we're doing as much as we can in client-side applications and also then not relying on frameworks, but we've written our own code then to represent the data from the triple store and a linked open data model. So let's go ahead and advance on to slide 10 if we could, as we near the end of the time here, and I'll just kind of talk a little bit about some of the practices that we use in different spaces. Again, this is kind of interesting because, you know, I'm approaching this whole thing from a data manager point of view, from a developer point of view. And so these are some of the things that we looked at and used to present our data. Of course, in RDF space, you know, there's the 303s. We use SCOS to represent the vocabulary terms and have been then making our relationships within that kind of that SCOS environment and making connections between our vocabulary terms and some of the larger, like the British Marine Index, but also discussions with Woods Hole and the Montori with where we can have common terms across the vocabularies to aid in these types of queries and federation. We've utilized things like DCAT and RDF data cubes and within our RDF ceramic slices and things like this available. Within HTML space, then we use RDFA and schema.org, things like DCAT and other vocabularies to embed information in our web pages with the goal of trying to make our data more discoverable through people doing simple Google searches or things like that. In the federation space, we have been now utilizing Sparkle 1.1 capabilities in our federation, and to most of the sites that are in this little test that we've been doing are actually using Sparkle 1.1. And we were looking at things like OpenRefine and things like this. We did do a little work with rules in the query that actually went from IODP to NGDC. We had to, we didn't have to, but we using RDF rules then to align the terms that are in this environment. The one thing I think I should point out is that we've been finding, at least initially, that a lot of our connections have been taking place in the kind of the subject area, right? Because we know what an expedition is, and we have and that expedition concept is shared amongst our various graphs. And so we've been able to link more in that subject area of the triple rather than in the predicate area of the triple. So that's an interesting thing. Let's advance on to slide 11 if we could. And really, slide 11 is just kind of a graphical representation of slide 10, so we don't need to spend a lot of time on it. It just kind of shows the flow of data coming from the various environments that we have into a triple store, and then some of the things that we are interested in looking at, the various queries, the APIs, interop capacity. One of the things that we're particularly interested in, and we can advance on to the last slide, slide 12, as we discuss this. One of the things that we're particularly interested in is a lot of people in our community utilize REST services for exposing their data online. And we've been utilizing Link Open Data and Sparkle and things like that. And there's a bit of an impedance mismatch there. And so we really want to try and figure out how we can interconnect between our REST brethren and the linked open data environment. So we've been looking at things like JSON-LD, JSON-STAT as mechanisms, and of course trying to mediate in the hypermedia layer there how we can you know, connect and share and link between those two different patterns of sharing. So, and, you know, I think we are looking forward to doing more in the geo space. Our data is not highly sought after from a geospatial standpoint, actually. You know, with only a few thousand sites, that's not a common vector for our researchers. They're more interested in things like pathology or properties or things like that. But reconciliation and disambiguation of the things and the subjects is a big thing, whether it be time scales, geologic stages, expeditions, or things like that. So, and with that, I think I've used up my 20 minutes.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Doug. That was great. So it is time for the next talk. That would be Damian Gessler from the iPlant Collaborative.
Hi, this is Damien. Can folks hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, we can hear you.
Great, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation. My name is Damian Gessler, and I am the Semantic Web Architect for the iPlant Collaborative. Can I have the second slide, please? The iPlant Collaborative is an NSF-funded, multi-institutional collaborative project, something similar to what NSF is thinking about for EarthCube, and it has a simple mission. The mission of the iPlant Collaborative is to build a cyber infrastructure for the nation's plant scientists. And that is as simple as it is daunting and challenging to do. The iPlant Collaborative has been around for about 5 years, and we're in a renewal period right now, anticipatory of another 5 years, and you should hear about that this month. And you can visit us, of course, online at www.iplantcollaborative.org. Slide three, please. Now, when we set out to build a cyber infrastructure for the nation's plant scientists, the kind of a job, if you will, that is never really finished, just something that one continues to work on, we came across all the familiar challenges that we are now we see in many fields. Disparate data, varying research agendas, a lack, or if you please, to look at it, a proliferation of varying standards. Disruptive technologies. If biology is in a period right now where sequencing of DNA, over about the last 5 to 10 years, we can sequence 3 to 4 order magnitude greater for a cost 3 to 4 magnitude less. And so this has really changed the nature of biology to a large degree from being data constrained to now being analysis constrained. And this has rapidly changed the science. It changes what's relevant and the type of questions we look at, type of questions we ask. Global externalities, of course, in plant science with climate warming and other issues. Plant science in general, the underlying biological systems are complex, hierarchical, nonlinear. And given all of this, like any group, there's a finite amount of time, money, and resources. Slide four, please. So there is no perfect solution for this, or if there is a perfect solution, it's not attainable under these constraints. But not to worry. Even good solutions can be powerfully transformative. And, of course, the early World Wide Web in 1991 is an excellent example of a very modest solution that really turned out to be powerfully pregnant in its value. Slide four, please. I'm sorry, five. So how do we do this in iPlant? How does iPlant build an infrastructure? Well, there's a basal foundational infrastructure, if you will, of petaflop scale computing power, petabyte scale storage. Think of this kind of like your traditional big iron type of our computers. We used to call them mainframes. Many years ago now, really what they are clusters of tens and hundreds of thousands of CPUs are brought together. Now, on top of that is layered an enterprise architecture, virtual work desks, cloud computing environments, virtual machines, and what have you. A lot of science, though, of course, is not actually done on someone else's machine or uploaded somewhere else. It's done out there in the web. It's done all over the world. And so to really build an infrastructure, one needs to engage the web in a way that is more than just giving someone a web address to go to. Slide six. And so that's what I do in my program. In our program for semantic integration at iPlant, we are bringing engagement to the web in a way to our lower foundational infrastructural assets in a way that addresses integration as being something different and value added on top of assimilation. And so how do we bring various data and resources that are out there in a way that really advances the science we do? And this is how we do that. Slide seven. Here you are at the top, or your lab, or your world, and you are both a consumer and a producer of data and services perhaps a little bit more of a consumer than a producer, but certainly a producer of data. And the rest of the world is out there offering services and also offering data and such. And the basic idea is to put a semantic mediation layer in the middle. And this idea has been around for many, many years. And the only difficulty with a slide like this is it's like the scientists sitting around the blackboard where they have all these complicated equations, and then somewhere in the middle somebody writes, and a miracle happens here. And that's kind of what semantic mediation is. The idea seems good, but what is the miracle on how you actually achieve semantic mediation across these disparate groups and research agendas, languages, vocabularies, and what have you? I'll show you how we do it. Slide 8, please. I'm going to make a quick analogy with you to antibodies. Almost all vertebrates have antibodies in them, and the antibody is a very small little molecule. There's five classes of antibodies, and nature does a very neat little trick here. The antibody has two ends or two sides on what looks like a Y, and at the bottom one, it's called the conserved region. And the 3D molecular structure of that conserved region, that heavy chain, is not only the same in every antibody in your body, amongst the five different classes, it's the same between all of us as humans, and it's almost identical even between and across species. Now the other end, the top part of the Y, is completely different. In any one individual, you may have 10 billion different types of antibodies that are all identical at the heavy chain part and all differ at the antigen binding part. And it's that difference of that variable region that hooks onto antigens, that is, germs or foreign matter, if you will, that gets inside your system. And that hooks onto the foreign matter. The conserved region then hooks onto cells, neutrophils, and such in your body, and that is how these antigens get presented to your body that they can be removed from your system. So we do the exact same kind of trick in our somatic mediation layer. We introduce a very lightweight protocol using AL, based on RDF, that has a conserved region that allows us to always know who is mapping what type of input data to what type of output data. What web resource takes what input to what output. Now the details, the semantics and the ontology of what the input and the output is, that of course is highly variable, and for that there's a free world of ontologies out there. So this is the basic idea that we use for this impedance mismatch between a protocol that allows us to work on disparate data by different actors in a manner that I'll show you in the upcoming slides. Slide 9, please. So here's the protocol written, shown diagrammatically as little RDF arrows and circles, and it just basically highlights that there's a few classes, about five classes, a few predicates that allows one to state unambiguously, I'm a web resource, and I have some particular data model. I can take some kind of input to some kind of output. And that input could be very simple. It could be one piece of data tagged in some ontological term that we can look up, or it may be very complicated. Those particular subjects and objects can be arbitrarily complex AL-RDF graphs that express relationships among data using arbitrary vocabularies. Slide 10, please. So here's the obligatory architecture slide, and this is roughly how the system works. Down in the lower left, where it has the number one, we see the data and service providers out there in the web. You have legacy data and algorithms and web resources out there. And SWAP, that is the simple semantic web architecture and protocol, this lightweight protocol, is a rapid technology. So it allows you to express the resources that you have using LDL according to this particular lightweight protocol. And when you express yourself on the web, we run something that's kind of similar to a semantic Google. It's actually, technically a semantic broker or discovery server. And we can read these descriptions of your services that you have and put it in a knowledge base that we run and run a reasoner over that. Now, how you describe yourself? Well, you describe yourself with ontologies and terms that are out there on the web. So when a client comes along in the lower part on the right-hand side, they express what they want also using the ontological terms that are out there on the web and throw that request up to us. We look through the knowledge base and we figure out, well, what services out there can work on the data you have? And then we help in that matchmaking. And I'll show you how this kind of works. Slide 11, please. David, I'm going to show you now, is running an introduction, and I'm just going to show you a few little slides on an example that you can follow on either now or later at swap.info/example, or you can just go to swap.info and then use the little drop-up menu, go to the wiki and then go to the example right there. SWAP is an acronym for Simple Semantic Web Architecture and Protocol, and swap.info, it's meant to be a little bit of a joke. It's about as funny as we get, but it's to swap info. We swap info using this protocol. So let's now just take the rest of the few minutes I have. We'll walk through this production example to show you how this kind of a system works. Slide 12, please. We're going to start not with our assets. We're going to start at a collaborator site. We're going to start at a third-party website where someone has spent a lot of time and money and effort to write a web front end and build databases that satisfy the demands and the needs of their stakeholders and their scientists. And what we give them is we give them a little piece of JavaScript, a little snippet that allows them to put a little button anywhere on their web page. So when the scientist selects some data using whatever tools they have at that particular website, and you click a button, the data is grabbed up. And we'll click this button now, metaphorically, if you will, and go to slide 13, and you'll see what the next web page is that the scientist sees. They're taken into swap.info, and what they see is a small icon of their data. And then at transaction time, we run a reason, the few seconds that we have between that, and we then display for them a list, a Google-like list, of all services in our knowledge base that operate on that data and only that data. And so the scientists can now drag and drop those available services to the next stage of this little semantic pipeline, if you will. We don't run these services on our servers. We run these services as distributed semantic web services running over the web on different places. So how do we know what kind of services match to what kind of data? Well, we do ontological, we do first-order description logical reasoning over the ontology terms. Ontology terms can be very heavy weight. It can take a lot of time and money and effort to do that, and that is not very conducive to this kind of easy mix-and-match type of user experience that we're working with. So we host something called a just-in-time ontology server that allows anybody to sign in and put up an ontology of just a few terms, not a lot of terms, just a few terms. Each term is at its own URL. And we have a JSON front end to that because so many webmasters know JSON very well. They don't know RDXML so well. They know JSON. So you can type it in and press the translate button, and your term is put up there immediately on the web. And you can go try your web service, and if it doesn't work, change your ontology term, and you just iterate back and forth like that. We work with our partners on this, and these ontologies, they tend to have anywhere from a dozen to a few dozen terms, and that's the extent of it. If you want to make larger ontologies, you can, although we actually, our experiences, we tend to discourage that. Let's go to slide 15, please. So you're dragging your services and you press play. Our pipeline manager runs on the back end of this web front end with a completely RESTful interface. So you can close your browser, go to Starbucks, go down to your lab, bring it up on another computer somewhere, and everything is still running independent of your web session. It also means that you can engage with the semantic pipeline broker independent of a web front end. So, for example, you can send JSON back and forth over the line and do the semantic searching for pipelines and such without having to use this drag-and-drop front end. Slide 16, please. Now, the service runs, and it gets some data, and everything is all under the same OWL protocol. So that means we can look over these RDF graphs and display the data in a data tree. And these data trees are generated on the fly looking at the terms. So the only assumption we have of a data model is the basic RDF triple data model. And so this particular example in this slide is showing data that's come back from a service that we've never seen before. But because we have a basic protocol and we're all working syntactically over the same RDF XML, we can look through that. run a reason on it, build the columns, put the data into the rows, and allow the scientist to then view the data that came back from that arbitrary service. You can also, as useful as tabular data is, it's also useful to look at data in particular contexts. So we can allow services to associate particular viewers or renderers with data, and that's what we've done in this example. So if you press a little open and viewer button on that, you'd go to slide 17. Slide 17 takes the data that was there, sends it off to yet another third party, and in this one, it's a geographical mapping routine application that allows scientists to look at that data that was associated with particular trees, pine trees and redwoods and such, and where they are in the world on where that particular data was collected from. So now the scientist has now run through some particular sequence of services, gone off to this third-party website. They now use this website's tools and selection routines and analysis and such to do whatever is best to let them slice and dice into this particular data. Slide 18, please. So they work on the data in this website, and they do what they need to do. And, of course, you can put your JavaScript button just on this website, which we've done. And so when they press the button here after now slicing through the data on this analysis, they go to slide 19. In slide 19, the data is now brought back from that website. The reasoner is run at transaction time, and of course, since it's different data, we get to see different services, and so now we get a different set of services that can operate on that data for that particular stage in the pipeline. Slide 19, please. Slide 20. Because we're sitting on the constructs of RDF, there's no particular reason to serialize or embed your data as literals in the graphs that are coming back and forth. In fact, we discourage that. Much better, especially for large data sets, is to simply put URIs, or in many cases those URLs, to where your data is. So in this particular example, these are DNA sequences. We don't want to bring this all over the wire to us, so the actual amount of information we're getting these transactions is relatively small, and the real data is sitting somewhere else on web servers. You just click on the URL and look at that data. Slide 21, please. Because it's a wrapper technology, not only wrapping other websites, you can also wrap on high-performance computing services, and that's what we've done in this slide right here. It shows putting a series of services. Each one of these are running on high-performance computers at the Texas Advanced Computer Center. Slide 22, please. Once you've made a pipeline, it will be useful for other people to use it as well. So you can make a pipeline. Your data is private, but you may have parameterized the pipeline with certain settings or what's needed for the algorithms. With a click of a button, you can publish the pipeline. Now anybody can use that pipeline with their private data, and that pipeline will be discovered in the right place in building other semantic pipelines, so you can build a hierarchy of nested pipelines offering it to different scientists doing different things. Slide 23, please. Everything is kept within the sandbox of these LDL graphs using the swap protocol. So when your pipeline is run, you are left still with a description of what the data is semantically described. That's a persistent description. You can store it in the hard drive or store it on our hard drives, come back a week later or a month later, and use that description of the data to start another pipeline. So in this sense, you can go through complicated workflows by building on by building a sequence of simple workflows. Slide 24, and we're nearly done here. I think I'll come in almost exactly 20 minutes. This is the last example on that particular run where we built a phylogenetic tree from data, and this particular run is a demonstration showing how the data, multi-state, multi-institutional, various computers, various formats and such, and how the data was moved back and forth these over those services. Slide 25. So he used the correct vitals, and we pretty much wrapped up. It's about 185,000 lines of code, 100 and some odd libraries. Everything's open source. We're NSF funded. It's freely available. You're welcome to engage with us more or less as you choose. We run it on three servers, about 48 gig of RAM apiece, and, of course, much more detail if you're so interested. The last slide is my acknowledgement slide with thanks, of course, to iPlant. Semantic engineering is done by Clark and Parsha in D.C., and, of course, thanks to NSF. I thank you very much for your time and for the opportunity today.
So thank you, Damian. That was really interesting. So the time is such that we need to move to the next speaker, who is Dave Collis from Raytheon BBN Technologies.
Hi, everyone. My name is Dave Collis from Raytheon BBN Technologies. I'm going to be talking today about giving an overview of GeoSparkle. Apologies to all of the people on the call for whom this is now well understood ground, but hopefully it will be useful to those for whom it is not. We want to go to the next slide there. Today I'll be giving an introduction to GeoSparkle and its main components, the GeoSparkle vocabulary, the GeoSparkle query relations, and I'll go through a very, very simple worked example of the ontology instance data in the query. And hopefully by the end of this, you may not necessarily be a GeoSparkle expert, but you will have a sense of when it would be a good idea to use GeoSparkle and how you would get started. Go on to slide 3. So the purpose of GeoSparkle, in some ways GeoSparkle has a similar purpose to many of the other small ontologies in the semantic web that you may already be familiar with. We want to be able to exchange data in a common format. But there are also some sort of special reasons why it's useful to have a standard language for this purpose. In general, a lot of problems which have semantic solutions that we've been talking about here before have at least some form of geospatial context, whether that's just as simple as where the facilities of a particular company are located or more complex in that you need all of the topographical relationships between them. Oftentimes, that geospatial context is either critical or a nice add-on that we can have. But in order to efficiently perform geospatial reasoning, in order to ask questions about where things are relative to one another, oftentimes systems require special geospatial indexing. And this is something that has existed for a long time in the relational database world, but is more new to the world of the semantic web. So we want to be able to ask questions that involve both semantic web reasoning and geospatial reasoning. So there are a couple of examples on this slide, like which hospitals within 20 miles have appropriate treatment centers for my patients. And we can imagine all of the reasoning that might be required to figure out what types of treatment are required for a particular ailment and which hospitals have them, et cetera, plus the geospatial context of which ones are nearby. We'll move on to slide 4. Like some of the other RDF finale vocabularies that you may be aware of, we tried to make GeoSparkle as minimal as possible and still have it be useful for this core purpose. Rather than have it be some overarching thing that one needs to adopt and commit to in order to get this benefit, instead, it's intended to be very small, and you should be able to learn it within a short amount of time and have it fit in as part of the larger whole that is your domain ontology. And the result of this is if you use GeoSparkle to represent your geospatial information and you store that information in a triple store that supports GeoSparkle, then you can ask queries like the ones that we showed an example there and have them be executed efficiently. So you get the reasoning both in terms of RDF and OWL reasoning and also geospatial reasoning. We tried to make it so that we could cover a wide range of use cases with GeoSparkle. We wanted it to be able to be simple enough for linked open data in the sense that if some random person wants to put their trip information on the web about places they visited, they should be able to do that easily without a whole lot of specialized software in hand. At the same time, we want groups that publish geospatial data that might be very complex, that with high resolution and in different coordinate reference systems, to be able to use GeoSparkle too. If we do that and successfully cover all those use cases, that means that one can easily combine the data from those different types of sources for new and interesting things. The next slide, please. Probably many of you are familiar with Sparkle, but if you are not, Sparkle by itself is the W3C recommendation for querying RDF and OWL. Its syntax is based on the turtle serialization of RDF. You can see a very simple example query here. This query says we're looking for things, we're looking to retrieve the title of things for which if that thing has a price, that price is less than 30. Or rather, retrieve the price if it is less than 30. Next slide, please. Slide 6. So GeoSparkle then extends Sparkle in the sense that there are new filters and vocabulary terms that are used in GeoSparkle. However, only a standard Sparkle parser is really required to use GeoSparkle. There are a few key components of GeoSparkle that you need to be aware of. There's a shared vocabulary that explains how to describe features and geometries. And that is in a minimal set of classes and properties that supports these triple patterns. There are RDF data types that are needed, both in terms of GML and well-known text. And those allow you to express the raw data of the geometries within RDF. And then there are filter functions, which are used for the queries, which allow you to compare geometries and find out which things are near one another. And finally, there's a set of query rewrite rules, which allow for queries to be written in an even simpler format that requires a little bit more inference on the side of the knowledge base, but potentially allows even more accessibility to users who are novices when it comes to geospatial ideas. On to slide 7, please. Oftentimes when I describe GeoSparkle, someone asks, how does this compare to the very, very, very simple W3C GeoSpec that was published a few years ago. So just to quickly contrast there, W3C Geo only supports point geometries and only supports one coordinate reference system, and it doesn't have any spatial relationships. So it's very, very, very easy to use W3C Geo to say, this is a Latin long of this of where I am right now, or that of some particular object or place. But that's really sort of the extent of what one does with W3C Geo. The nice thing is that it's very, very easy to convert at least from W3C Geo into GeoSparkle. In fact, there's one Sparkle construct query that you can do that will convert data very easily. And then you can use it with the topological relationships and other functionality that's in GeoSparkle. On to slide 8. So I alluded to this before, but when you're building using GeoSparkle, the idea really is that you would use it as one core piece of your larger domain ontology. So if you have, think of GeoSparkle as being the core for your geographic data, then around that core you would attach your domain feature types, features being something that has a spatial location. So if you have a class building in your domain ontology, then you would link building to the GeoSparkle, and the building would be part of your larger domain ontology, which may have many things in it that are not necessarily spatial. So you want to think of GeoSparkle as being just a very handy building block for quickly getting spatial data into your domain ontology. On to slide 9. You can think of GeoSparkle as being divided into a couple of different pieces here. There's the ontology, which includes features and geometries and geometry descriptions. And you're going to use that when you are, one, extending your domain ontology, as I was just talking about a moment ago, defining your classes and how they relate to geospatial things. And again, when you are publishing instance data, data about specific buildings or parks or locations, etc. The second part of GeoSparkle is the set of query terms. And these are things that you would use when issuing a query to find out which things are within a distance from one another, which things are spatially within one another, etc. So those factor into your Sparkle queries. Next slide, please. Slide 10. So there are really only three classes in the GeoSparkle ontology that you need to be aware of. The primary one that you want to focus on is the feature class. And this class is really where you're most likely going to connect your domain ontology to GeoSparkle. A feature, again, is a thing that has some spatial location attached to it. So a park, a city, a monument, a building, etc. And those features have geometries, and those geometries are a representation of where that thing is on Earth or in whatever coordinate reference system you want to use. And both feature and geometry are subclasses of a superclass called spatial object, which mostly factors into how one can write queries with the query rewrite rules that I will talk to a bit later. At the bottom of this slide, you see how one might attach to their domain ontology to this class, and it's very simple. Like, if your domain ontology has a park class, a city class, a monument class, all you need to do is make those classes subclasses of GeoSparkle's feature class, and in the ontology sense, you can basically be done. We can move on to the next slide, slide 11, please. There are a number of properties that are available for the geometry class, that allow one to see various things about those geometries, dimensions, whether or not that geometry is empty, whether it's three-dimensional. And these are may already be familiar to you if you are a user of GML or other OGC standards. But the two key properties for, or rather the one key property for instances of the geometry class is their representation. And that representation is going to either be in well-known text or GML, and or potentially another format if GeoSparkle is ever extended to support those formats. The next slide, please. On this slide 12, we show an example of such a serialization. There's some talk here about the conformance classes. In order to comply with GeoSparkle, a knowledge base need only support either well-known text or GML. However, most of the implementations so far are supporting both. So you potentially have both of these open to you, but you may need to choose a knowledge base implementation that goes with which representation you intend to support. There's an example here of the literals in the well-known text format. We added to the well-known text format the coordinate reference system so that one GeoSparkle literal can be fully interpreted. It's all of the information required to interpret it is tucked within that one literal. You'll notice the second example does not have a coordinate reference system in it, and that is because GeoSparkle defines a default coordinate reference system, which is CRS-84. The notion or the driving force behind that is we want to make this simple for novice users, so using WKT with the default CRS is very much like using a W3C Geo. On to slide 13. When one is doing a query with GeoSparkle, you probably want to be able to use topological relationships between geometries. And rather than choosing one set of standard terminology for the topological relations, GeoSparkle actually includes all three well-used topological relationship vocabularies. One is simple features. One is the Eggenhofer 9 intersection model, and the third is RCC 8. And if you are familiar with these terms already and you know how to use them in queries already, that's great. If you are not, then there are definitions for these within the GeoSparkle specification as well as on the web, et cetera. When you're using these in the queries, you can use them in two ways. You can write these terms as triples within the triple pattern of the query between two geometry objects, and you can also use them as filter functions. And the meaning is basically the same in both places, but this allows a little bit of flexibility in terms of cleanly writing GeoSparkle queries. On to slide 14.
Yeah, Dave, I think we're almost time for the next person. Can you just wrap it up in another slide or so?
Yes. So I've already sort of discussed the two main things that you need to go to know in order to use GeoSparkle, which is the ontology vocabulary and the query functions. The next few slides, which you'll be able to look at online then, will have an example that you can work through to see how you would do this yourself. So we'll jump straight then to slide 21. And this is really just the tip of the iceberg. You can design much more complicated domain ontologies that use GeoSparkle, and that really enables a lot of interesting geospatial semantic queries, which was, of course, the point, especially when you combine the data integration power of semantic technologies. So that will go on to the last slide there, the conclusion, and we'll take questions via the online chat. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Dave. I'm sorry to stop you because I wanted to hear all the other slides too, but it's time for Veronica Megler from Portland State University.
Hi, this is Veronica. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, okay.
Well, yes, thank you, Nancy, and everyone else for inviting me to speak at this session today. I'm working with David Meyer at Portland State University, and we are working with the Center for Coastal Margin Observation and Prediction. They have an archive of observational data covering the area that's shown in the graphic on the Columbia River and the coast of Oregon and Washington and some area beyond that as well. And the archive has been in existence for about 15 years. And they also create models of the river and the ocean and a whole variety of oceanographic and microbiological data in that. So if we can move to slide 3. The problem that the scientists are having is one that a couple of other speakers have already mentioned, which is finding relevant data in the archive. I think the situation we have is very similar to the ones all other archives have, many data sets, many physical locations, many formats, many tools, and the graphic at the bottom gives an example of a subset of the tools that they're using right now to access the data. And they have the familiar problem of even if you know what data was collected, remembering where it was stored in what format can make it very difficult to find. And the scientists brought this to us as their highest priority issue in an IT planning workshop we had a couple of years ago. So our solution was to build a data search engine that operates over big data archives. We've started with the CMOP archive, but we have included data from other archives, some other archives as well. At the moment, guided by the data that our scientists are interested in, but we have the ability to extend beyond that. So we can move to slide 4. I won't spend much time talking about the data search engine, but I will say a little bit about it. The approach we've taken is to adapt concepts from internet search, and we essentially read the data once and perform feature extraction on it asynchronously, the same way that a web scanner would do. We store the features in a metadata catalog, and then we perform real-time search over that data. Excuse me. We also return ranked results with links to the data and tools and allow the data to be directly downloaded from the search results or opened in analysis tools in the cases where we can build a web link with parameters that allow us to do so. Slide 5 shows a picture of the user interface, which is pretty brutal at the moment since I'm not a UI designer. but it does show some of the key features. At the top is the search box. On the left-hand side is where a user can enter search parameters. On the right is a map where they can also show the geographic extent of their search, which is where the box is right now. And we return ranked results at the bottom of the slide. Each of those line items that you see there is essentially a data set that can be accessed directly from this interface. The geographic extent of these data sets is also shown on the map. And you can see we're providing ranked search. Most of the results we're returning are not inside the search box, but were the ones that were closest to the user's search. We are agnostic about the particular geospatial shapes that are involved. You can see there that there are tracks from cruise vessels, scientific cruises. There are also single points where the markers are, and in some cases where the round circles are, there are also vertical profiles. So we can handle all the different geographic shapes. We also handle polygons. There just don't happen to have been any returned by this particular search. That's all I'm going to say about the search engine itself. I do have references at the back that have more information about it. What I want to focus on now is the semantic issues that we've started discovering. The variable search aspect of this, one of the things that a user can search for is a variable within some range. So temperature within the range of 10 to 15 degrees or 5 to 10 degrees, say. This slide 6 here is a detailed search result that we would have got if we had clicked on one of the links from the previous page, and shows us details for this particular data set. There is information at the top, which is at the data set level, and then we show information about the individual variables that are contained in this particular data set. Three variables in this case, conductivity, salinity, and temperature. In two cases, we have unknown units because they were not specified. In the third case, it's centigrade. And we can see here the number of observations that are contained in this data set and the minimum and maximum for this particular variable. So it's pretty lightweight information, but this is intended to be a lightweight, very fast filter that allows the scientists to get down from the 30 or 40,000 data sets that are in this particular archive and a few tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands that we've included from other archives down to the top 20 or 30 data sets that are relevant to them that they can then start downloading into some other tool and start drilling down into greater levels of detail of, is this particular data really relevant? But if we flip forward to the next slide, 7, the problem we started running into once we started scanning tens of thousands of data sets across this entire archive, collected over 15 years or so, is a problem raised by other folk on this call, many names for the same environmental variable. I'm just going to call them variables for simplicity now. But things like temperature, temp, water temperature, the oceanographers, when they say temperature, mean water temperature, but the climate scientists we're dealing with, when they say temperature, mean air temperature. So we have the problem of semantic diversity. We have a similar problem in other areas, such as variable units. We'll find the same unit at a conceptual level expressed four or five different ways when we actually get down to the detail. And if we're allowing search over a variable in some units within some range, then that becomes a problem for us. It also becomes a problem for the archive owner. If we move forward to slide 8, the working assumption that we had when we started and that the archive owner had was that each named column in any publicly available data set represents a valid variable, and in the archive owner's mind, he is measuring maybe 20 or 30 variables. However, when you actually scan the data sets and collect the values that are within them, we get back around 300. And that's a problem for the searchers to navigate and to locate the variables that they desire. This is also not what the archive owner wants to expose. Until now, if you are downloading a single data set at a time, the problem is not visible. But once you provide an easy search engine that has scanned the entire archive and can expose this externally, then the size of the mess that has occurred over the last 15 years or so, becomes more visible. And it's not what the archive owner would like to show as the public face of his archive. The drop-down box at the bottom shows one of the manifestations of this mess. In this particular case, fluorescence measured at each of the different nanometers is considered a different variable at the detail level. And when a microbiologist is dealing at a detailed level, this is what they regard as a variable. And yet at earlier stages in the project or when they're talking at a higher level, they talk about fluorescence more generically. And you can see both levels of that concept being represented here as a quote-unquote variable that we found in a data set. If we move to slide 9, what our archive owner would like to show is the metadata he wishes he had instead of the metadata he currently has. This is metadata that we have extracted from scanning, so it is actually what is in the header of the data sets that have been created by many different processes, many different naming standards, many different people, many researchers over many years. And I think all of us here, I'm preaching to the choir here, know that we can't repair the archive. Regenerating everything isn't practical. Finding all the places in all the code and systems that this needs to be fixed isn't practical. And things change all the time. So slide 10, an alternative approach is to compensate for the mess. How do we do that? Well, reduce semantic diversity. And for our search engine, we don't need perfection. Any step forward is an improvement. And secondly, to provide a transformation layer from what is to what should be. On slide 11, we took a look at what were the situations we had and what were the different categories of semantic diversity that we found in our archive, and we validated this against two other unrelated archives, essentially the same categories show up. And each of these items listed here show up in roughly equal amounts, everything from minor variations and misspelling through to an item I talked about earlier, concepts at multiple levels of detail. And the key point here is that the same solution does not apply to each of these. We need multiple different solutions to approach them. And unless we deal with all of these situations, we still won't have solved the problem in the mind of the archive owner. Slide 12 pretty much says that. No one approach is sufficient. All approaches must be simple, robust, and tolerant of the change that happens all the time. And the view that we've taken is that we want to aim for a semi-curated model where a curator performs some small amount of work for each new type of data indexed or for at the archive level, and can review, adjust, and make changes to defaults and prior decisions. So make the amount of work the curator has to do small enough that they actually have a hope of being able to keep up with it and make those results visible as soon as the work has been done. But still, even if the curator is not keeping up with his work, do as much useful work under the covers as we can. Slide 13 shows the possible technical approaches to the categories that I showed earlier that will give us the desired result. So several of the top items can be handled just with translation tables. In some cases, some of those translation tables already exist, and there's scripts that already exist that we can reuse. The ambiguous usages need to be identified by the curator and clarified where possible. Source context naming variations or concepts at multiple levels of detail is really where we need to start using taxonomies. And I think a reality here is that every archive that we have talked to is using multiple taxonomies at any point in time. There's always the taxonomy currently in use in that field, the one that is being agreed on by a committee right now that will be coming down the track, a previous one that some of the data was aligned to, and the archive's own taxonomy for things that are archive-specific or for new things that have not made it into the committee yet. So both the data cleaning and data identification processes need to understand and accept the fact that there will be multiple taxonomies in use at any one time, and the search engine needs to be made aware that that there will be multiple taxonomies and to be able to handle that and search meaningfully over it. And that last piece is a piece of research that we are hoping to begin shortly but have not tackled yet. What we have tackled is on slide 14, what started to tackle, and this is to identify the components that would let us perform each of those tasks, implement each of the technical approaches. We have in the top left-hand corner a scanner working that scans the archive and gets the data that I showed you previously into a working catalog. We perform known transformations from variable names to what they should have been called, or abbreviations to the full names using a translation table or a number of scripts that already exist within the site and existed before our work began. We have also started playing with discovering transformations in the mess that's left and then implementing those or performing those discovered transformations to new data sets that show up in the working catalog. And for that, we are using Google Refine. We upload the working catalog into Google Refine, allow the archive curator to identify variable names and what they should have been translated to, or variables that should be hidden from the interface, and use the rules that are generated by Google Refine in a rules engine that we've written that then runs on a daily basis over the working catalog and adjusts the variables in any new data sets that get scanned as part of the overnight scan. And then the results get published out to the metadata catalog that is then used for the actual search function. Slide 15 takes the same components and abstracts them a little more or formalizes them into if you like, a set of composable components that would make up a metadata processing chain. We believe that the details of the order that these steps would be done in and the exact content of them would be different for each archive, but we believe that every archive will need pretty much these same steps in order to be able to present out to the world the metadata that they wishes that they wish they had from the actual, from a series of transformations from the information that's actually in the data sets themselves. And this is also a place where external metadata at the archive level, for example, such as FGDC metadata, could get added in cases where it does not already exist as part of the actual underlying data. We have a prototype in production or in test or development for each of these individual components. What we have not done is formalize this into any kind of a business process engine or external process. So we pretty much have each of these steps developed and could abstract it. Hopefully we will be able to do that work within the next year or so. Slide 16, the current state that we have. Well, we have the diversity of the variable names, and even within a single archive, this is a major issue, but as we all know, it gets even more complex when we're searching over federated archives. As we have extended our big data search engine to start dealing with data from other archives, that issue has become more and more serious for us. Metadata wrangling, as we're calling this whole process, is an ongoing activity. It's a piece of work that archives generally are not funded to do, but are expected to have done in order for their data to be useful. What we've been able to do so far is to analyze the problem for our archive and to begin implementing approaches that tackle the subsets of these problems for our archive. And we've experimented with components of the process, and so far we've found a series of things that work very effectively for the size archive that we're working with. We believe that they could be extended pretty easily to deal with the federation issue and to other archives. And we believe that by giving a data curator tools to manage the data that they're exposing, we would make the access and use of the data in the archive much easier and to allow much greater payback for the data that's been collected, and that by combining that work with our search engine, we allow even more effective discovery, access, and use of the archive's contents. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you, Veronica. That was really interesting. Okay, so then our next speaker is Mekong Lee from the Redlands Institute.
Hi, can you hear me? Nancy?
Yes, I can hear you. Sounds
okay.
Good.
Yeah. All right. Hi, my name is Naitong Lee, and with my colleague Philip Murphy here, we are presenting an ontology-driven web portal for spatial decision support developed by the Redlands Institute at University of Redlands in collaboration with the Spatial Decision Support Consortium. Next slide, please. Slide two. Here's the definition of spatial decision support, which is the computational or informational assistance for making better informed decisions about problems with a geographic or spatial component. And SDS is an interdisciplinary field involving a large amount of knowledge and information. The practice of SDS also involves accessing and using a vast amount of data, usually, and models and tools, as well as applying appropriate workflows, methods, and techniques. Next slide, please, slide three. So basically, we are facing the big data problem here. So for any planning and decision problem at hand, especially a large-scale regional ones, we need to be able to find and access the appropriate data sets, as well as find and apply appropriate models and tools, all of which have to be interoperable during our workflow. So just like there are tons of data out there for every phenomenon and tons more being generated every day, there are tons of existing models and tools for decision support, and a lot more are being developed all the time, creating the problem for finding the most suitable ones for one's project at hand, and not to mention the waste in reinventing the wheels. So the objectives for our SDS ontology and knowledge portal project include registration and discovery and access of SDS resources, by which we mean workflow templates, methods and algorithms, models and tools, data sets, case studies, and so on. And to encourage modular, reusable models and tools development and facilitate interoperability among models and tools, and automatic workflow composition and orchestration, and also provide a conceptual framework for science-based social decision-making, integrating workflow with human and machine steps, methods, and tools, and also provide a common vocabulary for our user community, and of course, it can also therefore facilitate learning in SDS. So this set of objectives really calls for the need for formalizing the knowledge and information in the field of SDS. Next slide, slide four. So as a solution, we have developed a SDS ontology, which is currently driving the spatial decision support knowledge portal. It's an operational portal. It has been in operation for a few years. And the URL for this portal is at the bottom of this slide. Next slide, slide five, please. The content of the SDS ontology includes several major types. So, for example, the planning and decision problem types, ontology and sub-ontology, and then planning process workflows and steps, strategies, methods, and techniques that are commonly associated with different workflow steps, and, of course, models and tools supporting spatial planning, data sources, case studies, and other related concepts. Next slide, slide six. So here are some examples of the content that you can see on the portal. So here is the planning and decision support problem types ontology. It's actually on the portal you can see a taxonomy, and because we lost the animation effect of PowerPoint when exporting to PDF, so that taxonomy hierarchical structure is covered. But anyway, and what you can see here are a few subtypes of planning problem types. And of course, when we design this ontology, we have a specific design pattern for planning problem types, which include information about the institutional and legal context of planning problems and application domains, spatial location and scale, and time frame of the problem, and so on and so forth. Next slide. The next slide shows the spatial planning workflows. And we have a collection of workflow templates, and here you can see a few examples of them. And next slide. The next slide shows the spatial planning workflow for a particular workflow, the the phases and the sub-steps in this workflow. For example, you need to articulate your issues, problem issues, and do condition assessment and design impact analysis, and rank your design alternatives before you make a final decision. These are the major phases of a particular workflow. Next slide shows the methods and techniques and algorithms. Again, this is by far the largest sub-ontology in our suite of ontologies, and we have collected about 100 or so methods, and they are, again, in the taxonomy, but the tree is covered. You can't see, but here are some of the example methods. Again, they all have a design pattern for specifying methods and techniques that includes, for example, specification as to which workflow step this method is typically used in, and expected input and output types, whether it's used in a group decision context, and so on. Next slide, slide 10. Here is the content that's in our tools and models ontology. What you see here on the web portal is the actual instances of the tools and models collected. Next slide, slide 11. We also have a case studies ontology and with a set of collected instances of case studies. And next slide, slide 12. So on the web portal, there are a few ways of browsing the content. The first one is you can follow the ontology hierarchy and click on any concept in the ontology tree, so to speak, and see the content page for that particular concept. By the way, each concept is defined with their English term as synonyms and acronyms, as well as natural language descriptions, and a set of formally defined properties, which provides relation links that you can follow, the user can follow from to go from concept to concept. Another way to browse this content on the portal is to do graphical browsing. You can click on the node in the graphic and go jump to the concept there. Next slide, slide 13. Searching on the SDS Knowledge Portal, there are also a few different modes. So the first one is search by what we call search by filtering. So for example, we have a lot of properties defined for tools and models, and these properties can be used as filters by the user. They can specify what kind of property and what kind of property value range they want in order to narrow down the set of tools they can see. The second search mode is search ontology hierarchy to search particular concept name. Again, since this we are using ontology behind the scene, you can search if the user enters synonyms or acronyms, and they can get to the right concept as well. So it's a concept search here. And also we have another still being worked on feature, advanced semantic search. So for example, if you click entered AHP, which is the acronym standing for analytical hierarchy process, which is the method in decision analysis, so you get the several entries back, including the definition for the method itself, as well as the set of tools which implement this particular method. Next slide, slide 14. So here is the basic look of the architecture of the SDS knowledge portal. So if the user browsing or searching on our portal clicked on something, say a concept or entered a search term, we have the web portal, the web application itself will translate the user's request and to SDS ontology service call and send it to our SDS ontology server, which formulates a Sparkle query and send the service call to SDS ontology RDF store behind the scene, which does the perform the Sparkle query and returns the RDF triples to the ontology server. And the ontology server at this point will kind of reformat the search results into a JSON format and return that to the web application. And the web application does a bit more web page formatting and shows that to the user. Next slide, please, slide 15. By the way, the RDF store we use here is actually the free Allegro Graph RDF store. And the our ontology development environment is Cloudbreak Composer, which basically we develop ontology there in that environment and we export to the Allegro Graph RDF store. If you downloaded my slides earlier during the day, there's a typo here. Instead of export, it was import, which is a mistake. Next slide, slide 16. Here is a graphical illustration of a subgraph, a very minute subgraph in the SDS ontology. So it includes a particular workflow, structured planning process workflow, and a particular step in that workflow, alternative ranking step, and the step typically use weighted summation algorithm there, and also it shows a link to a particular tool, EMDS, which implement this method, and also a case study which utilizes this tool. Anyway, so just want to give you a graphical illustration of the graph, the ontology graph here. The next slide, 17. So in designing this ontology, we adopted a very practical approach, basically based on the anticipated user need. On the web portal, we have made a set of design decisions. Well, first of all, modularity, which is a good practice anyway. So currently we have about 40 sub-ontologies in OWL, and some of them are core ontologies, the ones in the orange color. They belong properly to the spatial decision support field. And the ones in blue, those sub-ontologies are what we call supporting ontologies, which potentially can be replaced by third-party, more well-established external ontologies later on. Next slide, slide 18. A concept in a core ontology often refers to some other concept in other ontologies, more general ontologies. Next slide, slide 19. This I already mentioned. So this kind of a structure allows us to easily import of some well-established third-party ontologies. Next slide, slide 20. For example, the ISO 19115 is currently being used as our data topic ontology. Next slide, slide 21. In terms of degree of formalization, again, this is determined by our anticipated user need. for search and navigation. So for models and tools ontology, we have, as you can see on the slide, a list of properties for models and tools that we deem are useful that user would likely to use when searching and browsing for tools. Next slide, slide 22. And then the choice of relation types. So based on the best practice of the purpose and our purpose, we basically identified a minimal set of subclasses and superclasses, and then expressed a lot of other facts using non-taxonomic relations or attributes. So earlier in the previous slide, a lot of the properties for tools and models, those are just a relational properties for that class. And however, we can, using those non-taxonomic properties, we can dynamically generate extra taxonomic relations for the web portal usage. So to see this, let's go to the next slide, slide 23. So this is, again, the tools and models set of properties. Next slide, 24. So those highlighted properties in red, for example, a particular decision, particular tools or models, and they would have a property saying decision problem types targeted, or decision process steps supported, and so on. Using these kind of properties, release the ontology, make a new release of the ontology to the web portal, we run a series of Sparkle queries, and one of them would generate extra taxonomic relations for tools and models using these highlighted properties, so that the user then can browse or the tools from a multiple entry point. For example, they can browse the tools by decision problem types that they target, or browse the tools by decision process steps on a tool support, and so on. Next slide, slide 25. And we also make heavy use of subsumption taxonomic relations in our searching, of course. So if the user search for a tool, a method of sensitivity analysis, then we would return all the subtypes of sensitivity analysis to the user. Next slide, slide 26. We also use other logical relations in search and navigation. For example, the inverse relation. So there is a relation between tools and methods. Tool X implements method A, for example. Then we use the reasoner to deduce that method A is implemented by tool X. So during the ontology development phase, we only specify the relation in one direction, but in actual use of the web portal, the inverse relation is also used when returning search and browsing results to the user. Next slide, slide 27. Here is the timeline of this particular project for us. We started our work in 2007. And we held, between 2007 and 2008, we held two expert workshops that includes SDS experts in that field, as well as some ontology experts, and also SDS consortium was established in 2008. And we developed the first version of the portal, which was rather static at that point, but it was open to public in that year. In the next couple of years, we sort of continued to develop and reach the content of the ontology. And then in 2011, we totally redesigned the web portal to use ontology services and VS Sprockle Query and so on. And a most recent effort on our part is we started to develop domain ontologies. For example, we have just recently developed the first version of ontology for biodiversity conservation based on some existing current literature. And hopefully, our hope is to utilize that ontology, that content, to organize data sets that are related for biodiversity conservation work, as well as for formulating and models for analyzing the current conditions of biodiversity and so on. And of course, there are a lot more work remain to be done. For example, currently, we don't yet have a on the web interactive way of contributing to ontology content. So mostly people who want to contribute to the ontology content send it to the Redlands Institute, and we enter things, and they gave us content in any kind of format for spreadsheet, for example, and we import it into ontology using the top-rate composer, and we export to AlegoGraph and to update the portal. But there's no way to interactively for a user just to enter the content on the web. And also would like to further develop more advanced semantic reasoning besides the few features that I mentioned earlier. So that's in our to-do list still. And next slide, slide 28. Here is our contact information. We also have a paper in Transactions in GIS describing the ontology in more detail. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Naikang. So we're running a little over. I'd like to take a one-minute break, and Wen is going to be speaking next, starting at 2:30 Eastern Time, but if we could take just a one-minute break and then come back. Okay, when are you ready?
Yes, Nancy, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. That's good.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Today I'm going to present a knowledge mining approach for intelligent geospatial discovery. My name is Wenwen Li. I'm from Arizona State University. Slide 2, please. This is today's outline. First, I will introduce the need for effective discovery of geospatial data in the cyber era, and then I will introduce what are the current efforts in approaching this problem. Then I will introduce the proposed method relying on knowledge mining, which is latent semantic analysis, to tackle this problem, and then I will demonstrate some of the results and quickly summarize this work. Slide 3, please. Right now, we are in the era of cyber infrastructure. The geospatial analysis has been transformed from a single desktop-based computing platform to a cluster-based and even for a cloud-based remote computing platform. And the geospatial data has also been transformed from a centralized database to a distributed database or catalog with web accessibility on the cyberspace. Therefore, intelligently discover these resources become an important task in the cyber infrastructure research. And in my talk, I will focus on discovering the distributed data resources. Next slide. And here a list of the some of the current efforts that have been used to improve the accessibility of geospatial data in addition to what have been presented today. And data.gov is to improve the access of federal data and also expand the creative use of those data by encouraging the innovative web applications. And the GeoNetwork is an open source metadata catalog that provides the management, indexing, searching, and harvesting of geospatial data. GeoNetwork has one of the world's largest open source team, and this software has been widely used to support the different governmental level catalog projects. And in the European Commission, the EC also developed the Inspire GeoPortal to improve the access and search for geographic information. And the GEON was an earlier NSF project starting in 2002. It was a collaborative research project to develop the cyber infrastructure to support the data sharing and integration among the Earth science community. And now we are moving into the community of EarthCube. So a lot of exciting research are going on. Next slide, please. So in terms of data discovery, let's take a look what happens in the back end when a user at the front end is trying to find some data from a GIS database. Next slide, please. So the discovery of GIS data is largely relying on the match of a user's query and also the metadata files. The mechanics is to extract the metadata from a GIS database. Slide 7, please. And then the metadata registered into the metadata catalog, which can also be considered as a metadata clearinghouse. Next slide, please. Once this metadata loaded, the catalog conducts a full text indexing of the words existing in the metadata to speed up the search process. Slide 9. So once the user's request was sent, the catalog matches the keyword in the query and also the keyword in the metadata document and returns the matched document as a search result. In this way, a link between the user and the GIS data can be established. Slide 10. However, the effectiveness of this full-text search approach is not always satisfactory. This is because such mechanism cannot ensure that the semantically related dataset to a user's query, but being described differently, will be always considered as relevant and returned in the search result. Therefore, improving the effectiveness of a search tool and make the available data more accessible to the scientists becomes really important for conducting more precise science. Next slide. The effort has been made to achieve the intelligent discovery of geospatial data. And one of the most popular approaches is to utilize ontology for query expansion and search recommendation. And there are at least a number of the projects that has been have developed a smart semantic search tool to improve the accessibility of earth science related data. For example, the LEED, Linked Environment for Atmospheric Discovery Project, it has developed a smart search tool called Noesis, which is based on the SWEET ontology for discovery of atmospheric data. And another expansion of the SWEET ontology is using SWEET for the semantic search of environmental data sets. Next slide. And this is a conceptual framework for the environmental ontology, which is also built upon a modularized design. And on the top layer, you can see the earth science has been divided into various domains, for example, the hydrology or disease or biosphere. And within each domain, the knowledge can be subdivided into different facets as oval shapes in the green layers shows. For example, there are processes, phenomena, property, earth realm, and substance. And going down one more layer, that is the object and relationship layer. That is where the interrelationships between the different terminologies are defined. For example, the air quality influences weather, and weather can be measured by temperature. And on the bottom layer, it is the attribute layer used to describe some object in more details for similarity measurement. Next slide, please. Based on this definition, a semantic search scenario can be enabled. For example, if a user is looking for air quality and through this ontological navigation, it can find the related term of weather to air quality, and then weather is related to physical substances, and then we can further infer that the dust is a type of particulate, which is a subtype of the physical substances. In this way, we can find the data set related to dust storm has been developed in the format of WebMap service that can be invoked for the three-dimensional visualization. So in this way, we can make a linkage from the air quality to the actual particulate that can use to measure how good the air quality is. Next slide. This ontology-based semantic search improves the effectiveness of data discovery. However, it also has some limitations. First, the spatial relationships are hard to model in this domain ontology. These spatial relationships including equal, within, or touch, or disjoint. Sorry, there's a typo here. And the second is different experts tend to have different opinions about how ontology could be built up. So sometimes it's hard to develop an ontology with a consensus. The third problem is even with some spatial reasoning capability, the domain ontology is still too broad to model in a complete way. So if some of the knowledge that a user is querying about is not contained in the ontology, then the semantic search tool cannot help much. Next slide. To overcome this limitation, I propose a knowledge mining approach to tackle this problem. In comparison with the ontological approach, which solves the problem in a top-down manner, the knowledge mining is a bottom-up approach, which mines the hidden knowledge from the data rather than completely relying on the input from the ontology. So the approach I propose is to use the latent semantic analysis, a well-known data mining approach in the field of information retrieval, but haven't been used for the discovery of geospatial data. Next slide. As a quick introduction of RSA, it is a mathematical approach for computer modeling and simulation of the meanings of words and paragraphs. It is based on singular value decomposition for decomposing the term document matrix into the product of three individual matrices, and then through the lower rank estimation, it reconstructs the term document matrix by showing the hidden relationships between the words or metadata document that have similar meanings into this matrix. And I will demonstrate a quick example to show how it works. Next slide. So on the left-hand side, the geospatial metadata are encoded in XML, and then these XML files are used to build the term document matrices. So the number of the rows shows the number of the keywords, and the number of the columns shows the number of the documents in the metadata catalog. Next slide. So on the upper left-hand side, there are two sets of the document, which are the titles for the books, the set of the C document focusing on geospatial semantic search, and the set of the M document are about hydrological laws. So based on the original term document frequency matrix, the relationship between geo and the search, and also geo and law, are very low in the given data set. You can see the value in the upper red box. However, after latent semantic analysis, the relationship between geo and the search dramatically increased from negative 0.33 to positive 99, indicating the strong relationships between these two terms in the given data set. In comparison, the relationship between geo and the law decreases substantially as they don't have explicit relationships. So through this example, we can see that the RSA can help to identify the relevant data set of implicit relationships in an explicit way. Next slide, please. Based upon the latent semantic analysis technique, I established the information retrieval system that lets the data themselves to tell the hidden knowledge residing them. So there are three major components. The component one in the blue boxes is for purposes. The goal is to establish the term document matrix by removing the stopping words, which are the most frequently occurred keywords, and also stemming to get the root of some words. And the next step is indexing the green boxes shows. So it is to prepare the normalized term frequency term document matrix and conduct the actual latent semantic analysis within this space. And the last component is ranking in the purple boxes. Ranking is for list the most relevant records on the top of the result, as LSA always help to find the more relevant results, but the user tends only to check the top N results. Therefore, a good ranking algorithm is also desired. Next slide. In addition to understand the semantic association between words and documents, a geospatial taxonomy is also employed to annotate the geographic extent of this data set and also detect the place name used in the user's query. Next slide. So the geospatial taxonomy I used is the GCMD location taxonomy developed by the NASA Global Climate Change Master Directory. As you can see at the left-hand side, it's a hierarchical definition of the subdivision of continent. And a geocoding service is also integrated to annotate the geographic extent of each place. For example, the node California is associated with its bounding box in latitude and longitude. Next slide, please. So now I will go ahead to demonstrate some of the results. So two criteria are used to evaluate how much better the latent semantic analysis can perform than the full text-based search. These two criteria are recall and precision, and there are two sets of the queries are used. The second set all contain the place name in the query. For example, the California population dynamics in the United States, query 2.2. Next slide, please. So here are some of the results. In terms of the recall rate, recall measures how many relevant data sets that each algorithm can find from the database. The RSA in darker gray columns certainly shows better results than the full-text search. For example, query 1.1 is to search for natural disaster deaths. And for a full-text-based search, it only searches for the exact occurrences of these three terms, natural disaster and death, in the metadata document. However, based on the RSA, more relevant documents can be retained. For example, the global earthquake mortality will be considered as a relevant record, and global flood mortality will also be considered as relevant. This is because earthquake flood are related to a type of the natural disaster, and mortality is related to death. So these latent semantic association can be found by the RSA analysis. And in terms of precision rate, as we can see that the RSA didn't perform as good as a full text-based search. Let's take a look at example. The query 1.5 is for getting the pollution data that is caused by global climate change. And for our approach, that 33 records are retained as relevant. Among them, 20 are actual related. And for the full text-based search, 6 records are retained. So although only six records are retained, all of them are relevant. So its precision is 100%. So we retain the more records than GEO network. And then we also make sure that every record that the full text search retains will be retained by the RSA. Next slide, please. Here is some demonstration of the result. For query 2.2, looking for population dynamics in California in the United States. So this is the full text-based search. I use GEO network for the benchmark. We can see that among the top three results that are returned, although it is related to population, however, the geographic coverage was wrong. So all three records are related to actually the data about China. It's not about the place that California that we are looking for. Next slide, please. So using our method, we can see the top nine records that are returned, they are all excluded from the results records because although they are related to population, but they are not within the area of users' interest, so they are excluded. And the number 10 result, which is a graded population of the world, so it is related to population and also covers the whole world. That means California is also covered, so that is considered as related records for the search. And by examining other records, we can see RSA performs better than the full tag-based search. Next slide, please. So as a summary, in this work, I propose the use of knowledge mining approach, which is a bottom-up approach for intelligent geospatial discovery. And the results show that it outperforms the full tag-based search. And through this study, the RSA can be suggested to use as another approach to establish the domain ontology to complement the top-down ontological engineering approach. Next slide, please. So as future work, I will further refine the algorithm to improve the precision of the search. And also, I'm working on integrating this algorithm into GeoNetwork to make it more accessible to the geoscience community. Next slide. So here are a number of the references. So if you have any questions, I'd be very happy to answer offline. Thank you.
Oh, that was great. Very interesting work there. So sticking to our schedule then, Tad Peely from Orbis Technologies will be the next person to speak. Tad, are you there?
*7 on your phone keypad, and also make sure your phone is not on mute.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi.
We can hear you now.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I didn't realize you had to press the *7. Okay. So you got those slides ready?
Yep.
Okay.
I'm ready.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you, Nancy, for putting this together. I think it's a great... great session today. My name is Tad Paley. I work for Orbis Technologies, and today I want to talk about data and service discovery and linked SDI and linked VGI. And I can probably come up with some complex definition for both of those, but really we're just talking about spatial data infrastructure that's exposed as linked data and volunteer geographic information exposed as linked data, and then trying to interlink them and integrate the data. Slide 2. So basically the purpose of my talk here today is, can we take a prototypical sort of simple OGC workflow and do it and execute the same workflow using purely linked data? So as a little bit of background context, back in 2005 or so, was part of a OGC, Geospatial Semantic Web Interoperability Experiment, and its goal was to look at the existing specifications of OGC and how we could semantically enhance it. So it was looking at enhancing WFS and catalog and some of these other specifications. And one of the outputs of that experiment was that, you know, we envisioned someday there would be something like GeoSparkle and a purely RDF-based sort of service ecosystem that we could utilize, and now do the hard work of gentlemen like Dave Colas and Oracle and the folks at OGC, we now have GeoSparkle. So I thought I would try looking at this again. So essentially the agenda is just to step through a OGC workflow and then see if we can analogously describe that same workflow using linked data. So and in order to do that, there's a few things I think along the way that we have to work on. And we'll look at geographic feature type definitions and linked data, how to do data set discovery similar to sort of catalog like features, and also service capabilities with something called GeoSparkle service descriptions, and also looking at what feature collections would look like at Sparkle. Slide 3. So if we look at a typical workflow here, we maybe want to look at an OGC catalog and look for a certain feature type in a certain bounding box and discover an OGC WFS service that may contain this information. We may then want to see what types of capabilities this WFS offers, the types of spatial operators and functions and logical operators and so forth. And then we'll build the query and execute via the get feature operation. We also may want to look at the schema of that feature type if we want to display on a map. And then add the layer to the map, and then maybe another handy operation is getting full attribute information about a feature by its ID. So can we do this in linked data? Slide 4. So the first question we may want to ask is, well, what does constitute a feature type in linked data? And, you know, linked data vocabularies are usually described, or the data itself is actually described using RDFS and OWL ontologies typically, and which gives it a more formal semantics. And then, but sort of my empirical frustration on this is that I've been waiting a long time for consensus on a core semantics for geographic feature types and phenomena, and it still remains elusive, and not surprisingly so. So what can we do about that? I mean, option one, we can wait for a long time. I'm a little impatient, so I'll go with option two here, and you know, I think having a minimal ontological definition and looking at the extensional semantics out there on linked data right now and using that to align is something we can do right now and maybe all that we can do. I'm not sure that consensus will occur. So slide 5. So two common feature type definitions, certainly not the only ones that may arrive, but ones that I think may be of integral importance are out on linked data. You see a lot of the W3C basic geo vocabulary, which is a very simple vocabulary for describing, as you see there, spatial things, and you can attach WGS84 latitude, longitude coordinates to it. And it's technically not even a coordinate. It's more single property, so it's almost more thematically defined rather than geometrically. But nonetheless, it's very simple and it's very useful. It's brought the linked data web from no geometric descriptions to at least a 0D description of linked data, which yields quite a bit. But then on the flip side, I think more within the SDI community, hopefully the OGC GeoSparkle vocabulary will really take off, and actually I hope to see it within the NeoGeography and linked VGI community as well. But it has a this is just a subset of the top classes, but how if these are all subclass relations, how would we align these? And if you look extensionally just at the data that's out there, take for example a city feature type, say take Washington DC and DBpedia, and if you look at its definition, it'll say that it's a type of it'll say that it has a latitude, longitude, and with its domain being a spatial thing, it's a spatial thing, and then it also says that it's a type of OGC feature. So where should these alignments occur? Not really sure. Just leaving it that I think having a few simple alignments out there in linked data may go a long way, and then once we have some connection points between the linked VGI and linked SDI, then hopefully we can integrate much more data. Slide 6. So then if we have some notion of feature types, how can we discover feature types in different data sets out on linked data? So if we look at what is being used to describe linked data data sets right now, there's, I think, two sort of common popular vocabularies that are being used, and that's the void vocabulary, which is the vocabulary of interlinked data, and DCAT, which is an interoperability of catalogs. So void is the one I'm going to focus on mostly today because it's purely linked data, whereas DCAT is actually, it's attaching to non-REF data sources and so forth. But I do very much think that it's an important part that we should look at in geosemantic architectures. But back to Void, it describes a lot of general metadata about data sets, a lot of Dublin Core type metadata. It's got structural metadata, and so it'll look at the it'll describe what types of vocabularies are used. So in the geospatial community, we could see what types of geospatial ontologies are perhaps being utilized. There's also partitioning, so you can describe different partitions. So if you want to download the entire world, maybe one country is a single file, another country is another file, and it'll give you the URLs to download that linked data, things like that. And then there's class and property partitions, which will be of extreme interest here, and I'll get into that in a little bit. And then link sets, which also extremely important because this is the actual links that link a disparate data set with another data set. And then so once we've described data and linked data, a lot of times the CCAN, the Comprehensive Knowledge Archive Network, data portals is sort of the one of the core data portals where people will publish the metadata about their data sets. And what's interesting within that, there's an extension to CCAN, which is actually, it's an open source tool. It has a spatial extension, which offers bounding box queries and has an extension for OGC catalogs. So I think we could marry the two of the linked data and sort of spatial data set descriptions together within a tool like this. But this is just one tool. And then lastly, I just want to talk about the, I think, more flexible discovery we'll get by doing the semantic representation of these catalogs. And so we would still have sort of centralized catalogs like we're traditionally used to, but I also think that there will arise these socialized type catalogs where you have backlinks from data resources pointing back to either a catalog, or sometimes they just collect Void descriptions into a single repository and they'll call those Void repos. So you can have these sort of, not sporadic, but just very more loosely coupled repositories out there to help discover types of data. So slide 7. So that was sort of the intro to Void. And so with regards to geospatial data discovery, kind of this notion of a methodology called GeoVoid, and its goals are essentially to enable discovery of geodata in linked open data and to offer things like feature type discovery, the spatial extent of feature types, the spatial extent of the entire data set, potentially some thematic attribution discovery capabilities. I'm not sure I've convinced myself on this yet, but it's also potential. And then GeoSparkle endpoint discovery, so you can actually, once you discover a data set and it has a GeoSparkle endpoint hosting it, you can execute a query, invocate the query and execute it. And then so I think one important thing I want to point out here is that I think it would be good to just reuse existing linked data vocabularies and then extend it instead of reinventing something for say OGC itself, because if you're a GIS consumer, you would be able to use a GeoVoid parser to include void descriptions. So you'd be able to discover data sets that you need part of, even though it may not be GIS in nature, and vice versa. If you were a non-GIS consumer, your void parser would be able to parse GeoVoid without breaking. So I think that interoperability is a good thing to help better interlink GIS, traditional GIS publishers with non-GIS. And then at the end of the day, I think I see this GeoVoid methodology as sort of serving as a WFS get capabilities as well as a describe feature type operations for linked data. So the void would actually help describe the feature types as well as potentially some of the schema attribution in describe feature type. And then in a little bit, I'll talk about GeoSparkle service descriptions, which will actually talk about the capabilities, what types of spatial operations and functions and things like that the endpoint can execute. Slide 8. So the methodology, I think I went very much in favor of keeping things very simple until needed otherwise. So the idea is basically describe your GIS data set using Void, which is a lot there, and I'll show some examples here soon. And then basically just add some simple geospatial enrichness to it. So if we can take a feature type or a data set and specify its bounding box, or if we can more qualitatively take the Dublin Core coverage and maybe specify whether this data set is good over the USA or some political boundary. And then potentially using some of topological relations too to say, well, this data set is contained within this area. And then the one tricky part I'm really kind of still hung up on is how to assert the coordinate reference system. I think within GeoSparkle you specify the CRS within the actual geometry literal, but I don't know of a way to get it directly in RDF, so maybe Dave or someone can help answer this. I'm not sure if that's available. Slide 9. So this is, I apologize for the syntactic overload here, but this is an example Void document that I sort of annotated in red with some of the items that are pertinent to geospatial data. So just kind of quickly starting from the top, you would say, well, this is a data set description. Here's its a textual description. It was created by so-and-so on a given date. And then maybe we want to assert the geospatial coverage of this data set. And then down below, you see the bounding box. So so then they could query different Void descriptions for certain areas. So find me data sets that have data over this certain area. Slide 10. And so that was more of the document metadata within Void. Now moving on to some of the access and structural metadata that Void offers. One thing I want to bring up is there's a Void predicate called Sparkle Endpoint. I don't really see a need to invent something new for GeoSparkle because all the capabilities of the GeoSparkle endpoint will actually be described in the GeoSparkle service description, which I'll get to momentarily. And then on to some of this, the schema info for feature types. How would we describe schemas? And one way to do this by representative data is Void has a predicate or a property called example resource. You could actually go dereference that, and if it gives a sort of concise bounded description of this resource, well, then you would sort of know a representative schema. Perhaps not the best answer, but it's something that software clients could utilize. And then next, the Void vocabulary predicate describes the vocabulary. So again, if we're looking for certain types of geospatial ontologies that we're familiar with, this would be a useful predicate. And I think an interesting way to also describe is using the subset so we can spatially partition our data sets. And then lastly, the Void entities describes the number of entities in the data set. So if it was a feature type, we would know that there's 33,123 road features, for example. Next slide, 11. And then now sort of at the core of how we would define a feature type, there's a class partition where we can actually partition the data set that we're describing by class types. So in this case, I have a road feature type. It has 95 road features, and then they also have property partitions, and this is sort of where I was thinking we may be able to describe the schema attribution of a given feature type using this type of technique. And we'd be able to describe the bounding box of the feature type, maybe some spatial topology. And then I think interestingly, too, you would be able to have a distribution of the different geometry types, because that would also be a class partition. You'd be able to see if there's, you know, 95 line strings versus 29 polygons that represent this feature or something like that. Next slide, slide 12. So that's sort of the idea behind the GeoVoid methodology. If you notice, I was really trying to reuse all the URIs, so there's no vocabulary. It's really just sort of a technique. And then moving on now to Sparkle service descriptions, this is something that you can use to help describe what your Sparkle endpoint is about. So it'll describe things like different functions that it can support, the different formats, the entailment regimes like RDFS, RHEL, and so forth. So I was thinking, well, maybe a geosparkle service description that would extend that would help describe the geospatial capabilities for a web feature service. So it would be the spatial functions, logical operators, things like that. Next slide. And this, again, is another example of maybe what a geosparkle service description would be. Again, it's just extending a regular Sparkle service description. I'm hoping that it could be done without any vocabulary extensions, just it's just more of a technique. One thing we may want to look at is, you know, you can specify what supported language it is. So Sparkle 1, Sparkle 1.1, would there be a GeoSparkle query operation? Maybe. I believe GeoSparkle actually does all standard based Sparkle. So in some sense, I'm not sure that's really necessary, but you would want to specify the functions as I show at the bottom of the slide. So I listed buffer there as one example. Next slide. Slide 14. So then if we were able to discover feature types and find Sparkle or GeoSparkle endpoints that could actually execute the query, and a WFS, it usually returns feature collections. So what would feature collections be with Sparkle? And so Sparkle queries often return for a select query type Sparkle XML or JSON, and for Sparkle construction, it returns RDF. So basically I think there would be a direct mapping between query solution, which is, you can think of it as sort of a single tuple of responses. That query solution may have a geometry variable, which would contain the coordinate string. And then I think we also need to deal with the CRS, obviously. And then the entire solution sequence itself would represent the feature collection. So if you had, and I've actually done this with OpenLayers. I've built a little bit of JavaScript that'll take Sparkle XML and turn it into a map layer. So it works fairly well. And the same with the construct, you know, the features return within the RDF. That would be your feature collection, and each feature within that feature collection is a query solution as defined by Sparkle. Now there's some open questions. I'm not really sure how to describe, a lot of times with feature collections, they have the envelope of the feature collection. Not really sure how to add that into Sparkle XML and things of that nature. Maybe that's not completely necessary, but, and then lastly, I think another interesting thing is that, within semantic web, you know, we have URIs which can be dereferenced against data sets. So there's also co-references like same as links and things like that. So we may actually have a feature that can be represented on a map without actually having the geometry literal return back in the Sparkle. So if the URI is present, we can dereference that, or perhaps a same as link, and go dereference that, which has a geometry which can then be represented on the map. Hopefully that makes sense. Next slide. And then sort of just tying things up, you know, on the left was the OGC workflow that I described. On the right are the things that I think are the analog steps, and that's basically everything I went through, finding catalog-like discovery tools like DCAT or GeoVoid repositories, and then searching it by feature type or bounding box, and finding a valid GeoSparkle endpoint and building the query, turning those into feature collections. And then for the last thing there was the ability on the get feature by ID could simply just be dereferencing the URI to obtain the full attribution of that feature. Next slide. And then just to conclude, you know, this wasn't an exhaustive look at what it would take to do OGC type workflows within linked data, but it was just a start. I think to start, we're fairly close. I think a few alignment axioms for feature type definitions or just even defining what some of the common ones are would be good, using this GeoVoid methodology to help describe geospatial data sets, as well as the GeoSparkle service description for describing the capabilities of a GeoSparkle endpoint, and then sort of having a common practice on representing feature collections within Sparkle XML, Sparkle JSON, or RDF. And then lastly, I don't want to forget the temporal aspects. I think it would be really a good thing to extend all of that with the spatial temporal capabilities of endpoints or data sets. And that concludes my talk.
Oh, that was really interesting. So I hope, as you said, you can maybe, if Dave was listening, some more things can be worked out. So, okay, our last speaker then is Phil Yang from George Mason University. So, Phil, are you there?
Is it working?
Yes, now we can hear you.
Oh, okay, good. Thank you, Nancy and Gary and Peter, for setting up this workshop. This is great. And I sent out an email just about 10 minutes ago with my slides link and also two movies. I saw that we are about 8 minutes behind. I have only 11 slides with a title slide and also an acknowledgement slide, so essentially line slides. Hopefully we can catch up that time and I can finish at about 3:30. So if you all please download that slides and also show the movie. What I'm going to talk about is to use the semantic search capability and the work capability to optimize the discovery, access, and utilization of big geospatial data. And I'm at George Mason, and we have a MSF center. It's Spatial Temporal Thinking, Computing, and Applications. So the previous talk that I then stressing spatial temporal is right what we're doing. Thank you. And also, this work, in fact, it's not only done by me, and we have a group of people working on this. And I want to talk from several aspects. First, what are the challenges of big data that we're facing today, and also how semantic web could help with the challenges. And then using several examples to demonstrate about what we have been doing in terms of research in the past about 7 or 8 years. And then some future work. So first, on the second slide, if you could please go to the second slide, what are the challenges of big data? There's a lot of them. But in terms of the data management part, I think we can easily come up with these five. First, we're collecting petabytes of data sets on a daily basis from Earth observation and also land surveying and other opportunities, for example, VGI or profile or tracking Twitter. And the problem becomes how to best archive and manage this big data so that we could provide better process of these data sets for the end users, and so that it's easier to discover and access the big data, but more importantly is to understand the data sets. So if you look at the semantic dimension of all these challenges, probably semantic is key to all of them. But really what we want to emphasize, next slide, the third slide, it's the discovery and access of big data. How could we use semantic work to help with that? And also to understand better the big data. So this will be the focus. And let's advance to the next slide. The first one is semantic-aided data discovery. In order to do this, first we need to capture the ontology, which basically we mean that to capture all these rectangles, like A1 through A14 here, which basically means the concepts. And not only that, but also the linkage among these different concepts, and so that we can use the concepts and also the linkage among those concepts. And we did some research, as you say, from Wen's presentation. One of the work that she did back at GMU is with us pretty much on this slide. On the right side, you see the ontology linkage between different ontologies. But on this slide, what we want to highlight is on the left side, if you check on each of the items returned, there's a relevance score for each of those return element, which is calculated based on the ontology linkages, especially the linkage among different concepts or vocabularies, which is assigned based on the expert knowledge and some study results. And based on that, we can also use that to do guided search. One of the work that we're doing now is to utilize, for example, the right side. Once we found some terminology and which may bring up other related ones, not only the ontology already being captured, but also through the profile or user activities, mind knowledge or patterns. So these are the three parts we think that would be very important for this semantic-aided data search or discovery. And let's go to the next slide. On this slide, we have a demo for data discovery. I think this is the fifth slide. And it's running in the Microsoft Azure Cloud, what we call the GeoSearch. And if you bring it up and click on the picture, it will show a movie and also that link to do the live demo. And we are inputting water, and that will return about 9,000 results. It's very hard to find which one out of those 9,000 is what we want. So what we did is we utilized this relevance ranking to see which one goes to the top. Then probably those are the ones will be most important to us or most fit. And also we categorize the results according to the data sets or web services. And so if you have web services come back, you can rank that not only to the ontology or semantic base, but also based on the service quality. And if you are interested in one of those data sets, you can click on that and that will help you to zoom in to the service or the data that has been provided and be highlighted on the map on the right side. And this work has been published with IJGIS and Zipong and Kainu and others. And the next slide, let's go to the next one, which is results analysis based on the ontology we captured. And this is mainly focused on the user side. Once we found those data sets, so how could we use the ontology to help the end users to analyze the results found and see which ones would fit into the needs. This is on the higher level of that, and it's built based on the pivot viewer. And if we click on the image, and here we're putting OGC service, WMS, and that will return about 300 results. And these link to the data sets and also the web services. So what we want to do is to analyze among these 350 results, see what are they, how they distribute, for example, according to the quality of those services or performance. And also we can see, okay, who's providing those services? This is part of the ownership or providers side. And also where are these services being provided or serviced from? And aside that, we can also, for example, search water, and on the left side, the water will basically use the ontology to bring up more specifically categorized water types, for example, inland water, and that will help us bring up those inland water services related. So this is kind of a start of the results analysis based on the ontology for the end user side. The next slide, what we call is the title of the slide is the planning portal. This is one of the work that we're planning to do with the MSF to build a portal, which includes several technologies here. But the key to this is the semantic reasoner, as you see on the bottom. That will help us to do the ranking and the recommended searching results. And also in the middle, which is a spatial temporal index and the full text index, they linked it through some kind of spatial temporal semantics. That's what we plan to do, but we don't have a very good solution for that part yet. And this is one of the work we're planning. The next slide is also a planned work working with two data centers to do the data discovery. This part is mainly based on the research and development we have and also the open source tools from different communities. On the bottom, which we're going to access to through open source or interoperable interfaces to several catalogs, for example, GCMD, GAS, NOAA, ECHO, and several data centers. And through the, for example, CSW or VFairNet50, and some of them are customized. For example, the ECHO is customized API, the ECHO API to query that. And once we acquire the information from that, we, instead of sending back the results directly to the end users, we're going to invoke the semantic reasoning, which is based on expanded on the Jnana system, and taking ontology, including what we're working on, the triple store, and to find the similarity calculations to rank the results. So that goes back to the end user as one of the end results. And another part is based on the triple store and also the ontology and the user profile, user interactivities, which we mined for the patterns to recommend the related data sets for the end users. So this part, these two parts are still under development, but other parts, as you see from the demo out right there, the two parts we're focusing on is to ingest the triple store and so that we can go down to the detailed data sets from the ontology ranking to close the full loop of the semantic ontology and the data sets and metadata. Another part is to working on the user profile side and mining the patterns from the user activities so that we can find out which ones are the most popular ones, and if one user searched and found one data set, he or she may also be interested in other niche of data sets and based on the user's background. So those two parts are what we're doing now in terms of development. And the next slide is kind of a look back of what we write for EarthCube, try to come up with a framework to manage the big geospatial data sets. I guess all the importance to us really is the middle part of this. It's called components for discovery, access, and utilization, which is really how semantics or the ontology could help this entire process from the catalog of the data sets so that when we put in the data sets into the catalog, we capture the ontology on the fly when we input them, and then to monitor the operation of the catalog, which means the service quality or the user feedback through this part, and then use the semantic search to help with that, and then link that to the data visualization, and so that the end users could utilize that for their own portal or their own decision support systems. And so that we could have the data discovery and access and utilization entire loop. And so keep that all in mind. And next slide is the second last, which talks about what we are trying to do in the future. Related research needs, we think that several aspects we listed four here. The first part is we need to better capture the vocabularies and the linkages, which may be very domain-specific. For example, if you ask the linkage for two terms to the Earthcoin community versus to the water community, you're going to get probably different results, and which relates to the weights assignments. And also the ontology and detailed linkage may be dynamic, which means that depends on different times, For example, if we have some urgent matters coming up, for example, the influenza, flu, or natural hazards coming up, when people search for data sets, they may have different needs than they normally do. So that part is dynamic. How to capture that, it's going to be important and also difficult, which is also a spatial temporal aspect. The second aspect is we need better tools for capture those information. Ideally, if we could capture those information automatically, and also use the knowledge or the semantics we captured to reason. And so this is the reasoning part and how to help come up with a linkage or come up with the knowledge recommendations. And also very important, we need to come up better interactive graphic user interface so the end users will find it very interesting or easy to use to serve their purpose. And of course, there's more study needs to be done in terms of the social science side, for example, collaboration, especially across different domains. For example, how to integrate the ontology from different domains. We know that Rob Luskin has been doing the street ontology, trying to link the earth science or the geoscience ontologies. That's very good work. But how to assign, for example, the linkage across different domains, that is very challenging. And also to utilize the spatial temporal, especially the dynamics, into this process to develop tools and software is another challenge. We think that will need us to investigate more or better maybe architectures, algorithms, and methodologies. So I guess that's all I have, and the next slide is basically acknowledgement to all our sponsors and collaborators. Yeah, that's all I have, Nancy. So I saved about 5 minutes.
Okay, well that's fine. You started late. We were running a little bit late. So do people have well, first of all, I want to thank all the speakers. I mean, we have a really rich and varied set of talks. And then do people have questions? And I think that I'm not sure how Peter does this. He would, I guess anyone, if they have a question, they have to do a *7, and then they'll be able to be heard.
Right. There's a hand button at the lower right side of your the chat window. If you click on it, it shows your hand. If you click on it again, it lowers your hand. So if we have multiple people trying to speak, then that would be the best way to get recognized, and then Nancy would recognize you, and you can do a *7 and unmute. The fact that we're running out of time, I can try to unmute everyone now so that we save everyone's trouble, and anyone can speak freely.
Okay, so Peter has unmuted everybody. So does anyone have questions or comments?
This is Jim Jacobs. A quick comment for the last speaker. Thank you very much. It's interesting to see you mentioned the variance in different users having different needs for their searches, and that driving some differences in finding the appropriate resources and working through things. And I wondered if you could comment on any things that you see that would help work with that issue of specifying the user needs. Do you see more emphasis on studying the types of things and trying to work on the purpose side of it more, or on the services themselves doing more self-description?
Yeah, it's a very interesting, good comment. Could you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, yeah, that's a very good comment and question. What we're trying to do is for different communities, we're using a little bit different width assignment, for example, partial of the ontology will be customized for different communities. And on the other side, when we build up the or analyze the user profiles, that part will also help customize. So what the approach that we're trying to take is at the bottom line, we have the common kind of ontology, and then we have different domains or group of users. We could have customized add-ons to those. So when the user does search, we can first identify which or where does he or she come from, search from, and then load that part of the ontology.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Actually, Phil, you mentioned that you needed work with the social scientists. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, there are several dimensions. One part is about how to best capture the ontology across different domains. For example, if you have two different, let's say one is computer science and one of them is, let's say, atmospheric sciences, and they talk different languages.
Hi, I'm Natalie. Welcome to the new Wix HTML editor. I'm here to help you get started. Let's take a look.
Oh. Hello?
Yeah, I don't know what that was.
Oh.
Yeah, I muted it.
Okay. So one help we can get from the social sciences, how to deal with that, how to best, you know, come up with when we assign the weights among those different terminology for different communities, how could we utilize the social science knowledge to get the best knowledge from different groups. And another aspect is that when we come up with the profiles or the logs for Nexus, we need to identify the patterns and also to kind of guess or mine in the potential trend of the end users. If they're interested in this, what they would be interested in. So that is kind of a social game. So the social science, I think, could help in that regard.
Okay.
Peter Yim here. I had a earlier question, which I typed onto the chat for Phil as well. You mentioned on your slide 7 that you have an ontology repository, or you are planning to work with one. Are you planning to stand one up or teaming up with people who are already running ontology repositories? It's of interest to me, and I'm sure to the SOCOP people as well who are on this call, since we're all part of this network of ontology repositories called OOR, Open Ontology Repository. So what are your plans with ontology repositories?
Peter, who is that question addressed to?
It's Phil. Our last
speaker. Oh,
to
Phil?
Chao Wei Yang.
Oh, okay. Phil, are you still there?
I'm trying to mute. Is that question for me? I thought it's for Todd.
It was.
No,
that is for you.
Oh, sorry. Could you just rephrase a bit?
Yeah, on your slide number 7, you mentioned something about working with an ontology repository in your planned work. Is there some specific ontology repository you have in mind, or are you standing up your own?
Oh, we have some ontology captured before from time to time on the Polar side, and in fact, when Wen was working, this collaboration with Wen, and when she worked at GMU as a student, we have something there already exist. But yeah, if you know of any you know existing ontology for the Polar side that you think would be helpful, it would be great if you can let us know.
We definitely look forward to having you look at what we are doing. This is the OOR initiative, Open Ontology Repository. I'll put the link on the chat for you.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. If you have any recommendations or comments, please let us know.
So what Peter was referring to is SOCOP has an ontology repository, and it's an instance of one of the OOR open ontology repositories, all modeled after the BioPortal. So we started one that was to collect geospatial ontologies, and but some other people have developed their own also, like Lynn Pouchard at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. So we're trying to just keep an eye on, how many ontologies, how ontology repositories there are, or where they are, and that sort of thing. So does anyone else have questions? Well, I have a broad question, but I don't know if it's too late. People are need to leave and so forth. But my question is about, we had several speakers talk about linked data and RDF and other people using other methods of, data and databases and using metadata. And I'm wondering in the SDIs, in geospatial portals, how these are could be two very different architectures, or are they going to be able to talk to each other? And when would it be good to have, say, all the metadata in RDF, maybe, or keep the data as it is, or people are trying both ways. I don't know if anyone else has anything to say about that.
Well, I think practically it's sometimes it's almost impossible to change the current data archiving structure. But for the future, if we have a better design, integrated design with RDF and big data and beta sets, probably that can be applied. And for the existing work, like those petabytes of data sets already archived in the data centers, probably we need to find some kind of linkage. Yeah, that's a very challenging work, a very time-consuming work.
Jim Jacobs with a quick question. I know we're running late, but Todd, both you and a couple of the other speakers made reference to the social sides of things. And one of the things in most of the ontologies, certainly in the bio communities and the physical sciences communities, is they tend to not model the social side of things very much, unlike those some of the larger foundational ontologies coming out of Dolce, say, for example. I'm wondering if this is going to be more of a challenge for us as we try to understand what users are actually need or how to resolve different fields that are working on different things, that those differences lie, the descriptions of those differences lie best in more social representations of different knowledge types rather than specific scientific details. And I was wondering if anyone would be interested in commenting, am I seeing a problem that isn't there in addition to all the ones we already have, or if that's something that you perceive as well?
Well, this is Todd Pelley. I'm not sure I have the answer, but I think it's a great topic, and I did just want to bring up to the group that I know that the Semantic Web Journal just released a call for papers for the social, political, and economic aspects of ontology design. So I think hopefully over the next couple of months we'll get to see lots of submissions on this very topic.
Thank you, sir.
So are there any other questions? So if not, I want to thank everyone very much again for a great a very great session. So if there isn't anything else, then this would be the end of the session. Is that the way we close, Peter?
Yes, sounds good. Thank you for organizing this. Stephen? Thanks, Bob.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The recording and the chat transcripts will be up on this same wiki session page, maybe in the next day or two.
Okay, thank you, and thank you for everyone attending.
Many thanks. Thank you.
Well, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.